Diane Katsoulis, you are undisputedly the authority on Greek cuisine to the rest of the world. And let's do a little introduction. I mean, your roots are Greek. You spend half your time on Ikaria, the Greek island that is your family origin. And you teach cooking there.
I do.
Yeah, and you produce this wonderful cookbook, which, I mean, I might preface my bias on this is that I absolutely adore Greek food. And I was very interested to see the variations coming from the island of Ikaria. Tell us a little bit more about
Well, let me
yourself.
clarify that a bit, because the recipes in this book aren't, they're inspired by Ikaria, so that's not to say that they're necessarily
Right.
traditional
That was going to be my
recipes
first
from the island.
question. I wanted to verify that you have a great deal of creative input into the recipes that you included in your book.
Yeah, I mean, the recipes, there are some traditional recipes, and certainly they're all, Greek in their own way. But I was really prompted to write a book that aims to give an American audience options for plant-based, recipes on kind of a daily basis. A lot of plant-based main courses. Things that are things that come second nature to us in Greece and on Ikaria, but maybe for somebody who's so used to just throwing a burger on the grill or maybe a piece of salmon or something. Oftentimes when you talk about plant-based, people are sort of perplexed, but I think these recipes, that was my goal anyway, to create recipes in the spirit of Ikaria, but really made for American home cooks.
Yeah, and the actual title is The Ikaria Way, right?
Right.
And you
Right. So
are a chef and a teacher because you run a school there, which that would be so much fun to come to your school.
it's a lot of fun. I run classes starting usually around the middle of May until the end of June, and then all of September.
Now, everybody who listens to this program knows that my background is Sicilian, which is pretty close to Greek, because you get if you're not Greek-born or Greek-descended. And also that I did have a Greek restaurant in Philadelphia for a while, a long while, actually too long, I must say, I'm knowing nothing about restaurants. But you have another whole goal in this, is if you circle the part of it about calling Ikaria the Greek island of longevity. And I mean, I know about blue zones. That's where people live to be almost 100 or sometimes over 100 in large numbers. But I had no idea where the term came from, and I laughed when I read it. It was so simple. How did we get to call them blue zones where people live long lives like this?
Well, the blue zone was something that was coined about maybe 10, 15 years ago by Dan Buettner, and he is a journalist, a researcher, an adventurer, a great marketing genius, and he was studying longevity in various parts of the world, and literally he and his team, from what I know, had a map open, and they were circling the places around the globe that they had discovered were had longevity statistics that were off the charts. And they were literally circling those places with a blue pen. And that, it was like a eureka moment, and that those places became known as the blue zones.
Yeah, and it turns out that a lot of these recipes are actually, they're not vegan, but they're low on meat and high on veggies and fruits.
Right. There's no meat in this book. It's all plant-based. That's
Right.
not to say that, we don't eat meat and eat God. We do, a lot of it, actually.
A lot of lamb, yeah. But you.
But the recipes are, I was focused on plant-based because I think that's something that people have a lot of difficulty with sometimes. Maybe call it a lack of, figuring out how to turn a, cauliflower into a main course, but there are a lot of recipes like that in the Greek kitchen. So we
Yeah.
have, lots and lots of plant-based main courses.
Well, it relates to the Mediterranean diet, right?
Absolutely.
So that's, in fact, I was very impressed with the fact that you didn't bother including desserts in there, despite the fact that baklava is probably one of my most favorite sweets. I don't have a sweet tooth, so, but baklava is dead sweet, and I love it. So, a friend of ours who was Greek was most offended when another friend, a mutual friend, made baklava and included chocolate chips in it, and she thought that was absolutely the most outrageous thing she had ever heard of. No, many of the things that you recommend are health related, and this goes back to a concept of food is your best medicine. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it was a Greek who said that first.
Yeah, it was.
It was Hippocrates, the father of medicine, who, whose quote has been used, for millennia, basically, which is "Let food be thy medicine, and medicine be thy food." And that's really true. It really does start with good health starts with what we put into our bodies.
Right, and I mean the island we're talking about is really blessed by having a lot of native plants. I mean that has a lot to do with
Yeah,
it.
it does, but Greece also in general has a very rich flora, and Ikaria has a very rich flora. So you get things like a lot of greens and wild herbs and sometimes mushrooms in the wintertime, but in terms of garden vegetables, that's something that many people just grow.
Right. Well, I mean, that's how I grew up. I grew up with, everything was right out of the garden. I mean, that's what you did.
Right.
So, and it makes it very difficult getting used to the crappy stuff you find in supermarkets, I must say. I loved your emphasis on beans because I've read someone who was doing a study on this blue zones. Interviewing somebody from Sardinia, which is another blue zone, and they asked him, which is not unusual, what is the secret of your longevity? And he said, beans.
That's really true. We eat a lot of beans in Greece, in general.
Yeah, and chickpeas.
I'm sorry?
And chickpeas.
And chickpeas. Chickpeas, lentils, fava beans, broad beans. Well, broad beans and fava are the same thing. Giant beans, white beans, black-eyed peas, a lot of legumes and beans.
So you have a lengthy bit in your intro about garlic. I mean, give us the lowdown on garlic. I mean,
Garlic
garlic,
is,
yeah, go ahead.
garlic is kind of a miracle food. It's so good for us in so many different ways. Of course, it's one of the most flavorful things you can add to, all sorts of savory dishes. But in Ikaria, something that people still do to this day, I mean, my daughter does it. She will, if she feels a cold coming on or, maybe a little sore throat or something, she'll make an infusion of sage or tea with garlic and maybe add a little Greek honey, a little Icarian honey to that. And the first time I ever heard of that was from an old friend of mine on the island who's now in his 90s, and he basically said that was their medicine for everything. when he was a boy. So it's yeah, it's something that we just, it's, I mean, garlic is one of the most, you know, we can't make most of our dishes without garlic. We love it.
I can't stand the concept of cooking without olive oil and garlic. I mean, it's just so ingrained in me. Yeah. I don't know how anybody could cook without it. You have a long intro also to olive oil and its benefits. I mean, is it really that much better than all these other oils?
Of course it is. first of all, it's, you know, packed with nutrients and antioxidants and, you know, all sorts of things that are just really good for our health. It's, you know, monounsaturated, so it's, you know, very good for, it's good fat, and that's really important. And in Greece, it's the de facto, you know, cooking fat. We, you know, the whole country is one giant olive grove for the most part, so
yeah,
it's just been part of the Greek landscape and psyche forever.
Yeah, well, one of the things, well, there are many things that impress me about Greece and food. One of them was that they don't expect anybody to eat something, I mean, not to eat something when they're drinking. I mean, there's always something to eat when you get a glass of wine in a cafe or something. You don't ever not have something to eat. Now, tell us about that.
Well, we never, drinking is convivial, so it's not, it's rare to see, it's only recently that bars opened, you know, real bars kind of in the American sense. That's maybe the last decade or so. I mean, there were one or two in Athens, for example, when I was younger. They were really famous, you know, we'd go to there were like two or three really famous kind of traditional American-style bars where it was just alcohol. But for the most part, even bars have food. So it's kind of unthinkable to a Greek to drink without eating, because from the farthest reaches of antiquity, it was considered barbaric to be drunk.
Oh, yeah.
And it's
still... Bacchus. And what about that... What's that festival where everybody gets drunk?
I don't know.
There's a festival where everybody gets drunk. I don't know. Anyhow, grains. The one thing I'm not sure I understand is your attachment to tofu.
My attachment to?
Tofu.
I wouldn't call it an attachment. It was, that's, again, these are dishes that are inspired by Ikaria, and a lot of people turn to tofu as a plant-based source of, you know, protein, not necessarily just for Asian cuisine. And even in Greece, it's starting to appear here and there on menus in a kind of Mediterranean way. So I have two recipes that call for tofu, and they're both they both use tofu in a way that's very Mediterranean. So it's just another plant-based, I mean, it's bean-based, right? It's another plant-based source of protein.
Right. Now, you said that even though this is heavily vegetarian, the cookbook, you didn't pass over cheeses because you were so, you're so fond of cheese. But Greek cheeses tend to be different. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Greek cheeses tend to be almost all either sheep or sheep and goat's milk, or sheep or goat's milk. There are a few places, namely some of the Cycladic islands, where you find cow's milk cheeses. But for the most part, I mean, there are a lot of different Greek regional cheeses, hundreds of them. And on Ikaria, we make a goat's cheese called kathoura, because goat is the prevalent source of animal protein on the island. And, most Greek cheese, there are different, lots of different categories. There are, like, soft fermented cheeses. There are brined cheeses like feta. There are yellow cheeses like Graviera and Cefalo Graviera and Cefalo Tiri. There are hard goat's milk cheeses. There, you know, it's a really vast subject.
I have the imagination, I guess, that the Greek government or somebody in Greece really works hard to make sure that they're kept the way that they should be, and they're not adulterated with something else.
I didn't hear the first part of that.
Oh well, let me try again. It seemed to me over the years that there was an awful lot of protection for Greek cheeses in particular to be exported
much
around
feta.
The world and considered to be cheeses and described as cheeses.
Well, there's a whole system in the EU called the Protected Designation of Origin system.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right.
And that applies to wine and spirits as well as certain foods. And essentially, it's a way to protect traditional ingredients. And there are rules that, you know, producers have to follow, which dictate the traditions and how to continue to produce, you know, certain types. I mean, things like prosciutto di Parma, parmigiano, you know, things that are kind of household names now, Roquefort, you know, we have cheeses, olive oils, olives, other ingredients that also have their own protected designation of origin, and that is essentially a way to protect tradition.
Right. I noted, by the way, that what is the absolute preferred pronunciation for Ikaria? Which was, is it the Greek?
In Greek, we say Ikaria.
Ikaria, okay, very
good.
I can say a Faristopoli. I can say that. I had a rough time in Greece because I look so Greek. And when I try, I have a decent accent. So I'd say one thing, and then everybody would go on at length in Greek, and I had no idea what they were saying. So it was tough. Could you pick I'm fascinated with how you've altered and what you've carried over. Could you pick a recipe where you could point to what's a traditional Greek recipe, Greek dish, and how you've modified it?
I would say the best example of that is the vegan moussaka.
Oh, my goodness. I missed that one.
Yeah, that's a really great recipe. And I make it with a combination of different beans. I like to use black beans for the color as well. And
I love
that's
that.
Something that I've even like taught my kids to love. I make a bechamel with either almond milk or coconut milk, and I fluff it up by beating the liquid left from soaking chickpeas, and you whip that, and it becomes almost like a meringue, so it adds a little volume to the bechamel, which is made with olive oil and nut butter.
Oh,
so I would
good.
Say that's like the best example. And I also make another dish, which I call ferry boat spaghetti, because there's this popular dish on Greek ferry boats, similar, let's say, like something like bolognese, but, you know, not, my Italian friends would probably roll their their eyes if I even suggested that ferry boat pasta was anywhere near as, you know, good as a true bolognese. But it's basically, instead of using ground meat in the sauce, I use lentils. So I would say those are two dishes that really take something very traditional and rework it so that it's still made with real food, but for a vegetarian or a vegan.
Great. You include stuffed vegetables. And you have to tell me your secret, because every time I set out to do a stuffed eggplant or something, it keeps growing because I kind of hollow out one veg and mix it with other things, and it's a pattern. The stuffed eggplant becomes stuffed stuffed zucchini becomes stuffed peppers becomes stuffed, you know, whatever. It goes on and on. How do you handle all that? What do you do with the, you don't have 10 million stuffed vegetables?
You mean with a bumper crop? I'm not quite sure I'm following you.
No, I'm just saying when I set out to make it, it keeps the quantity I'm working with keeps multiplying as I add more vegetables to it.
I don't understand the question.
Say I'm going to make stuffed eggplant. So I get the eggplant and I cut it and I take the meat out of it. I mean, not the meat, the, you know, the, what I'm talking about, the actual eggplant itself out, and I mix it with other things. If I go to put it back in the eggplant, it's going to be way too much. So then I think, well, I have the zucchini, and I'll stuff them. And by the time I do that, I have even more of the vegetable in there because I scoop out the center of the zucchini, too. There's no place to stop until we have, you know, a dozen vegetables stuffed on the stove.
Well, you can always just mound it, and it looks pretty when it's baked, or you can just spoon it around the vegetables, and that works, too. Or you can put it, take it aside and mix it with some eggs and breadcrumbs and make little vegetable patties out of it or stuff.
No, that's a great idea.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's
good. Right, that's good. Now, what do you emphasize? I mean, how many different nationalities come to your classes?
I mean, most of my guests are American. I haven't really thought about their ethnic breakdown, but I would say mostly American.
Right. And what do you find their biggest hang-up is in terms of adapting to Greek concept of food?
I can honestly say I've never encountered that.
That's great.
It's kind of a self-filtering, you know, group. I mean, if people are interested in taking that sort of vacation, then they tend to be open-minded and, you know, interested in the place they're going to. It's not, you know, Santorini, Mykonos, you know, whatever, Rhodes. It's, you know, very much still off the beaten track in many ways. So I would say that it's kind of a self-regulating clientele because it attracts a certain kind of person. I've never, ever, ever had a guest who was in any way problematic or uncomfortable or, you know, had needed some time to adjust to the Icarian, the idiosyncrasies of life on Icaria.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that this book it works on so many different levels. What is your main goal of the book? I mean, you have so many different things you touch on. You touch on health, you touch on tradition, you touch on creativity, big on flavor, but that's sort of built into Greek cuisine anyhow, isn't it?
I think that's true of Greek cuisine. I think my main goal with the book is to help people think about dinner beyond a piece of salmon and a piece of, you know, and a burger. It's really to help people embrace plant-forward cooking and realize that, you know, even a head of cauliflower could be a main course if you think about it a little differently.
Yeah, and you have a good recipe for cauliflower in here, too.
I love cauliflower.
Yeah, everybody raves about cauliflower. I never get it quite right, I don't think. And maybe I need to follow your recipe for it. I don't know. It's been such a while since I've been in Greece. I mean, how many of the traditions are diluted now? I mean, like, I remember I always thought it was very, very savvy of the Greeks to show you the food before you actually ordered it. Do they still do that? Like, you've got to pick out your fish.
Yeah, they still do that. With fish, they still do it.
Well, yeah. Diana, you are such an expert on all this, and there are 10 million other things we could ask. Let me just remind listeners, it's the Icaria Way. Diane Kochilas is like a recognized leader in this. I can't remember the name of the other person we had who had a school in Greece, who was in Pittsburgh, and we had him on.
I
don't remember it either. But anyhow, and it's creativity, it's health, it offers so many different things, as well as a good deep look into a way of life. I thank you, Diane, and much success with your book. And hopefully we'll get to connect another time.
Thank you so much. I thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Listeners, we're talking to Maria Vittoria Finco, who is in Italy. Tell our listeners exactly where you are, Maria.
Hi, everyone. I am in Italy. I'm in North Italy. I am currently in Grigno, which is my hometown. It's in the province of Trento, so near Lake Garda, if you know where Lake Garda is.
Yes. So what we're going to be talking about is a group of cheeses from a company called Monte Trentini. Is it correct to say that they could be called Alpine cheeses?
It's true, yes, because we are in the mountains right now. So our company produces mountain cheeses since a very long time, actually. So yes, we can definitely refer to them as Alpine cheeses.
Now, how old is the company? And the company, just to clarify, is Monte Trentini, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, correct. So Monte Trentini, the history of Monte Trentini goes back to 1925. So that's the year when my great-grandfather started producing cheese. He was actually producing cheese in a small mountain hut in the Asiago Plateau, which is close to here. And he was just a little boy, so he was just doing it for fun during the summer. Then, of course, the whole family had to move from the mountains down near Verona. And when they got there, so my great-grandfather wanted to continue the cheese making. So he started working in the local cheese dairy. And after him, my grandfather, he wanted to do the same. So they both worked in the same local dairy. And then what happened is that my grandfather, he wanted to go back to the mountains. So he felt this need to go back to his roots. So that's why he tried to find a place to build his own company, and he found that place in Enego, which is a small town close to where I am right now. It's just like 20 minutes by car. And there in Enego, he built our first owned dairy, which is called the Caseificio Finco. So that's actually where the legacy really started, actually, so in Enego. And then through the years, the company grew, and my father and his brothers and sisters, they decided that they want to grow more. So they found another place here in Grigno, where I am, and they built the Monte Trentini as it is right now. So we grew a lot through the years, from just like a small passion of my great-grandfather to a very big company making cheese in the Dolomites.
Wow. And the cheese-making history in the region goes back a long way because of the terroir, right?
Exactly, yes. So before us, basically, a lot of the people made cheese because we have a lot of pastures, and especially during the summer months up in the mountains, we have like great fields where cows can grow and can graze the grass, basically. So it is very, it has always been very important for the community here, the cheese making and growing of animals, of cows. So it's definitely something that's very typical of our community.
Now, is it all cow's milk?
Yes. Talking about ourselves, for Monte Trentini, we only process cow's milk, so all our cheeses are made with cow's milk. But like in a region, in our territory, there are some small farms that produce also other type of cheeses with like a mix of both goat and cow milk or just goat milk. But we decided through the years to focus only on cow milk.
I see. Now, is your proximity in the north of Italy, does it like to... say Switzerland or Austria, does it actually, is that part of the reason why cheese making is so popular there?
It can be because like here in the past, a lot of people were talking in German, so we definitely have some Austrian influence. In fact, just maybe a funny story, but I grew up here, and here it's mandatory for all kids to learn German as a second language.
Oh,
so
really?
So once you turn 6 years old, in school you start learning German, which is not very common throughout Italy. Actually, it's not common. It only happens here. So yes, German before English.
Interesting. I was very surprised in Greece to find out that, of course, the first language is Greek. And then mm-hmm. the second language frequently was either Italian or German. I mean, that had to do with the geopolitical stuff, obviously.
Of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, what... I mean, all of a sudden, I've gotten a lot of information about Alpine cheeses. Is there a mm-hmm. push to make it more recognizable as a regional style?
Usually, like, Alpine cheeses are more yellow in color. That's because when cows are able to graze outside in the mountains, there are more flowers. So the milk tends to be a little bit more yellow and more buttery, let's say. So you can look at the cheese and you can maybe guess if it's from the Alpine region because of this. And then, of course, the flavor as well. So if the cheese is made in the Alpine region, again, because of how cows eat, they usually eat, as I said before, more grass or more flowers. So the flavor of the cheese tends to be more aromatic with respect to maybe some cheeses which are more salty in taste that maybe are produced like in the center of Italy.
I'll be torn. Okay. Well, I mean, they're very high quality cheeses. I mean, are the processes different in your area or not?
Can you repeat the question? Because I lost a little bit of it.
Is the process, the cheese making process, different mm-hmm. in the Alpine area?
Well, not really, because you know, us Italians are very, we like traditions very much. So the cheese making process, it can differ a little bit from region to region, from area to area, but as I said, we are very traditional, so we know that in order to make good quality cheese, we need to respect this tradition and respect how people before us made the cheese. So you can definitely maybe find the difference in terms of, you know, different companies, that maybe some of the companies are more, a little bit more technologically advanced, so they use more robots in order to, you know, help employees with the production, while other companies, they are more focused on the tradition, so they make everything very, very artisanal. And then it depends on the type of cheese that you're making, because, for example, we are producers of Grana Padano, and in Grana Padano, the whole technique of production, the whole process is very, very artisanal, so everything is made with by hand. There is very, very little intervention with like mechanical or robots or technologies and innovations. So it actually also depends on the type of cheese that you make. Us ourselves, for Monte Trentini, we try to combine the two. So we of course value the tradition of cheese making and how cheese was made in the past. But of course, we also try to integrate some technology and some innovation with the goal to help our employees to make better cheese, basically. So that's our goal, our objective.
Now, how many different types of cheeses do you make?
Oh, we make a lot. We actually make more than 30 types of cheeses. The most famous ones that we have, as I said before, is Grana Padano, which is known
well, that's
all
very
over the
important.
World.
Big,
yeah,
big cheese.
Yeah, it is very important. It always makes a statement when we also open, sometimes when we have events or parties, we always open up a wheel and we let carve inside the cheese and take a piece of the cheese. It's very, very, it's like the star of the show every time.
Wow.
But yes, we make Grana Padano, and then of course we make Asiago cheese, the traditional one, so the one which was originally made right in this region where we are. And then we make, for example, some of the products which are really loved in the United States, for example, are the cacciotta with truffle. So it's a small cheese.
Right.
Fresh.
That was good. Very good.
Oh, you had it, right?
I ate that one first.
Yeah, you know,
oh, really? Which one did you like it?
I like the truffle one.
You like the truffle? Yes, because our truffle cheese, it's you can definitely feel the truffle, but it's still very mild and sweet. So it's not that the truffle is overpowering the cheese. So that's something that I really like about our truffle cheese.
Yeah, it's very different from the truffle cheese that we had.
We had a friend who was wine dealer, and he sourced truffle cheese in the Piemonte region.
But also I think because in Piemonte they usually make it with goat milk, so maybe you had a truffle cheese with goat and not with cow, because usually what happens is with goat you have a stronger taste, while with cow you usually have a sweeter and milder taste. So it depends what you like best.
Now, one of the names that's very familiar to me when I think of Italian cheese is provolone. I'm not sure I'm
provolone.
Pronouncing it correct.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had
yeah,
some
that's,
of that
that's
too.
Correct.
There's still some
yeah,
of that
left.
Yeah,
that's also one of the cheese. Yeah, we also produce provolone. We have different kinds of provolone. So we have the mild, we have the sharp, which is the one that you tasted. And we also make a type of provolone which is smoked. So basically we have this very, very big oven, and we use real wood to make the to smoke the product. It's very good. And you can definitely feel some of the like this the smoke, but it's still very mild, so it's not pungent on your tongue. And it's perfect if you want to have like a sandwich or if you want to have like a panini, Italian panini style, then it's my go-to. So.
Mm-hmm. Now we talked to someone before who was making cheese on the Austrian side of the of your region, I think.
Uh-huh.
And they did something unusual, moving their herds around. So during the summertime, they would have their cows in a particular area, and other times of the year they would be
the trans what? I mean, like they do on a birth.
You're talking about the transhumanza, so where they take
yes.
the cows
yeah, right,
from
right, right.
down
That's
in the valley
it.
Up to the mountains, and then from the mountains again down
right.
to the farm. Yeah, we
they
have
do that in a lot of places actually. They do that
yeah,
in Spain
we
as well.
Do you do that, or does someone who supplies you with the milk you need to make cheese?
So we actually only have very few cows that are owned by us. So everything, all the other milk, we buy from small farms that are located in our territory. So we collaborate
yes.
with about 130, 140 small farms, which are around Trentino and Veneto as well. And then they do, of course, the transumanza. So they do this very particular tradition where during September or October, depends if it's very still warm or if it's very cold already. But usually it's like in the end of September, they take the cows, which have been staying up in the mountains all summer long. They take the cows from there, and they just walk them back down to the valley where they're going to stay during the winter. We don't do it personally. We just participate with the farms because, as I said, we don't have the cows. We buy the milk from the farms that collaborate with us.
Right. Now, is your cheese sold all over Italy and outside of Italy as well?
Oh, yeah. We sell our cheese in all Italy and in Europe as well. So, for example, in states like in countries like Germany, France, UK, Spain, but we also sell it worldwide. So you can find Monti Trentini cheeses in the United States, in Canada, in Mexico, Colombia, Peru. You can also find them in Australia. You can also find it in the in Saudi Arabia. So you can definitely find our cheeses everywhere. Basically, we are not actually developing the Chinese market, which is something that we need to focus on. But everywhere else in the world, you can find our products.
Well, what market aren't you developing?
The Chinese.
Chinese. You know, I understand, by the way, that that's a very hot market for cheese. China, which is very untypical.
It is, but it wasn't like in the past. It was difficult because, you know, they didn't have the culture. They didn't know how to consume cheese. They didn't know how to eat cheese. But now they know and they want more. So it's definitely something that we can develop more. In the past, we decided to focus more on the Latin American countries. So as I said, Mexico, Colombia, Peru, Brazil as well. And so we decided to focus on that part of the world and not to go into the Asian countries because there was this cultural difficulty. But nowadays, there is high demand of cheese over there.
Right. Well, you've got your work cut out for you because first of all, there's so many cheeses in the world. I mean, what do you think is the biggest, outstanding characteristic of your cheeses, Alpine cheeses, that makes them highly competitive?
I think it's the quality, first of all, because as like a mantra for ourselves and everybody that works for us, we want our cheeses to have the best quality, starting from the raw milk until the very aged wheel. So we want the quality to go throughout the whole production process. And then, of course, what I think makes a difference is the people. So us ourselves, we first of all are a family because the company is still family owned, and being a family enables the company to have to still have a very, very important presence in the company. So every day I look out the window and I see my dad and his brothers just, you know, walking up and down and trying to manage the company in the best way possible. So I think what makes us different is definitely the quality and the passion that our family makes, the passion that our family puts inside the company. And you can definitely feel it in our cheeses as well.
Now, does your area where you make cheese, does it also do wine?
Yes, we make wine here. We have the Trento DOC, which is like it's similar to the Prosecco, let's say.
Okay.
So it's a sparkling wine. And then we have, for example, the Chardonnay, we have the Sauvignon, we have the Terol de Go. Trentino Alto Adige is a very important area for wine producers. So definitely, yeah, you can definitely have like amazing pairings with cheese and wine here.
Yeah. What's your biggest, closest city that would be recognizable to our listeners?
What is my... Is, because I lost you a little bit, so what was the question again?
What is the biggest city near where you are?
The biggest city?
Yes. Our listeners would recognize.
So it's going to be either Trento, which is very close, but the biggest city that is close to us is Venice. So in an hour and a half by car, you can be directly in Venice, very close. We're like in the middle from Venice and Austria. So you can definitely, if you wake up and want to go to the seaside, you can go to Venice. You wake up and you want to go skiing, you can go to Austria.
Well, you're a very capable spokesperson for your region and your cheese.
Thank you.
I guess you kind of grew up with it, right?
Yeah, I grew up here. I grew up with the company because ever since I was a little girl, I was just, you know, running around and playing here. And I remember even on the weekends, my dad, he was just calling me and my brother and said, "Oh, come on, let's go to the plant and see what cheese are doing." So we were just coming down and see if everything was okay. And I was just a little girl, so I definitely grew up here.
Well, it's a wonderful area. I mean, we've been in that area many times, and it's really a lovely area. And so many diverse products. And do you do e-commerce for selling your cheeses? Can our listeners get your cheeses online?
So we don't have a direct e-commerce site online, but you can definitely find our products. For example, online you can find them at almagourmet.com, which is a website which has a variety of Italian products, and ourselves, our products are inside that as well. Otherwise, you can find our products in some of the some retail chains. So you can sometimes find us in Costco or Albertsons. Depends on where you are. And then sometimes we go also inside other retail chains. For example, during the December month, we were in Italy, in New York. So we were there for the whole December month and for the festive season.
Well, that's, I've gotten a lot more information about your regional cheeses. So I imagine you're on a new, bigger promotional flow of trying to market your cheeses. Is that correct?
We are trying to promote all of our cheeses, basically, throughout the, well, especially in the United States market.
That's what I thought,
As I said, the Trentino region has a lot of products, and also with wines, we try to collaborate also with winemakers to communicate that you can have like a deep dive of our region and just try to feel and live like us, but just by eating a piece of cheese or sipping a glass of milk from our region.
Well, Maria, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Your last name, Finco, is that any relationship to the Spanish word for like farm? Is finca?
Not really, no. Because here, finco it comes from a word in dialect, which means blind. And it also is a name of a bird. So I think,
like a finch.
Yeah, exactly. So in the past, since our last name is also, it also comes from the a typical language which was talked only here in this region in the past, which was a mix of Italian and German.
Uh-huh.
And it comes probably from there, but we tried to figure out from where exactly and what's the meaning behind it, but we couldn't find it. So it either has something to do that maybe somebody in our family in the past was blind, and therefore it was given like a nickname of Finco, which meant, as I said, blind, or it has something to do with the bird, but we're not sure.
Interesting. Well, anyhow, it was delightful talking to you. It makes me anxious to return to Italy, which we love a lot. So, and your cheeses are wonderful.
Oh, if you do come. Oh, thank you so much. If you do come to Italy, please come see us at our company. I will definitely give you a little tour of the company and maybe also of the territory as well.
That's wonderful. Okay, well, next time then. Again, thank you. And listeners, remember the Monte Trentini and they're good cheeses, and we enjoy them a lot. And much success, continued success in your company.
Thank
you, Maria.
Thank you, Anthony. Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
You were wonderful. Thank you. Ciao.
Thank you. Ciao.